disaster. In the next lecture, I want to talk about another tool in the philosopher's toolkit, another type of thinking of increasing importance, thinking with models. In this lecture, I want to draw on the problem-solving strategy of visualization, the problem-solving strategy of simplification, the problem-solving strategy of thought experiments. We've worked with all of those before. I want to bring them together in order to apply them to the kind of if-then connections we talked about with regard to scientific experimentation. There is a conceptual tool that incorporates all of these. It has a long and distinguished history, but with the advent of computers, I expect it to have an even more important future. This lecture is about thinking with models, all kinds of models. I'll start with an example drawn from the work of the economist and political scientist Thomas C. Schelling. This is Schelling's segregation model, one of the contributions for which he received the Nobel Prize in 2005. Schelling was as familiar as the rest of us with the de facto residential segregation characteristic of American cities and suburbs. If you look around your neighborhood, it's unlikely that you'll find a statistical cross-section of racial and ethnic groups. Are 15% of your neighbors Latino? 13% African American? 4% Asian American? 1% Native American? 67% white non-Latino? Probably not. Ethnicity maps of American cities typically show white areas, African American areas, Latino and Asian areas. Schelling's question was this: what does that say about racism? Do those ethnicity maps show that we're all more racist than we'd like to think? Schelling decided to construct a little model to help him think that question through. He drew a checkerboard grid on a piece of paper. Just a lot of squares. He reached into his pocket for change and used dimes and pennies to represent two ethnic groups. He distributed those randomly across the checkerboard, making sure to leave some empty spaces. I encourage you to try this yourself. The dimes and pennies were the agents in his model. The checkerboard was an abstract model for residential space, where those agents lived. In an initial random distribution, pennies and dimes would have been pretty evenly distributed. What Schelling thought of as the neighbors of a penny, or a dime, were those in the immediate squares around it. The neighborhood for any square are those 8 squares touching it on each side and on the diagonals. Schelling then gave his pennies and dimes some low-level preferences. The dimes weren't racist. They did want to live in a neighborhood where a third of the people around them were of the same ethnicity, but they were perfectly happy to have two-thirds of their neighbors different. The same was true of the pennies. Two-thirds unlike them, fine, but they would like at least a third of their neighbors to share their background. He picked a random penny or dime. It would have some other pennies or dimes in the immediate neighborhood around it. If at least a third of those were of its kind, then it could stay where it was. If it had less than a third of its own kind around them, it would move to a random empty space. So we have a random distribution. Nobody is particularly racist, but they do want at least a third of their neighbors to be like them, and they'll move if they don't. What happens as we play those preferences out? Even with those low preference levels, distributions on the board start to form little neighborhoods. They're little patches that are mostly all dimes. It starts to look a lot like the residential segregation characteristic of American cities and suburbs. Much of contemporary computer modeling is just an extension of that kind of thinking. Here's a computer simulation, a computer instantiation of Schelling's model, just larger and done by a computer rather than by hand. The same low-level preferences on the part of agents, the same resultant pattern of de facto residential segregation. Schelling's is a great example of what I mean by a model. In the original, there with dimes and pennies on a hand-drawn checkerboard, he was thinking with a model. In a sense, thinking through a model. Let me emphasize some of the important characteristics of that case. The first is that Schelling didn't just think it through in his head. He manipulated pennies and dimes on a hand-drawn checkerboard. We've seen that lesson before. Thinking doesn't have to all be in your head. Thinking shouldn't be confined to the dark and lonely recesses of your skull. Thinking is something you can do with your eyes. That's the strategy of visualization. We have amazing abilities of pattern recognition, instant, detailed, and accurate. It would be a shame not to use those abilities in thinking. If we can convert an abstract problem into a picture, something we can see, we can often think it through much more effectively. That's how Pythagoras may himself have thought through the Pythagorean theorem, thinking visually. Pythagoras may actually have manipulated tiles. Look at that. Sure enough, the area of the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Pythagoras may have thought the theorem through using a model. Pythagoras may have been thinking with his hands, just like Schelling with his pennies and dimes. In order to think, you don't have to strike a pose like Rodin's thinker. Indeed, that's probably not the most effective thinking pose. I'll bet Rodin himself didn't strike that pose when he thought about his sculpture. It's in fact very likely that he thought it through with a piece of clay. He thought it through with his hands. It's very likely that Rodin thought the sculpture through by using a model. Thinking is often most effective when you recruit your eyes to the task. Thinking is often most effective when you can manipulate things with your hands. Both of those show up in thinking with models. A second and obvious characteristic of Schelling's model is that it uses the strategy of simplification. What he's out to understand is something very complicated: social patterns of housing by ethnicity. Those patterns are the result of innumerable, careful, and complex decisions by thousands of interacting individuals. We know those individuals are influenced in their decisions by employment patterns, demographics, the complexities of housing availability, mortgage practices, individual finances, and life histories. Schelling's model includes none of that detail. It doesn't even really have individuals who belong to ethnic groups, just pennies and dimes. It includes no real representation that's anything like a map of any city, just a checkerboard drawn on a piece of paper. Do you remember the Tower of Hanoi problem? You have three posts in a row. The middle and right posts are empty. On the left post are stacked a series of six disks, ordered from largest at the bottom to smallest at the top. Your task is to end up with all six disks in the same order, but on one of the other two poles. You can only move one disk at a time. You can only move a disk from one pole to another. And you can never put a larger disk on top of a smaller one. What is the least number of moves in which you can get all six disks in order from one post to another? An important strategy for that kind of problem was simplification. If you want to know how to do it with six disks, start with just two. That'll give you a basic understanding of a pattern of moves required to solve the more complicated problem. Move the top small disk to one pole, then the one under it to another, and move the small disk on top. For three disks, you can do the same thing for the top two, then move the third disk to another pole and repeat the original dance with the two smaller disks. Seven moves. By the time you get up to six disks, that compounds to 63 moves. Schelling wants to understand something much more complicated than that, and much more real than the Tower of Hanoi problem. He wants to understand why residential segregation might happen with real people in real cities. That makes the simplification of his model far more outrageous than the Tower of Hanoi with just two disks. But the strategy is the same. Try to understand something complicated by understanding something related, but much simpler. Now let's look at the structure of Schelling's thinking. The model works with an input and generates an output. It goes from input to output by way of what I'll call the mechanism. Three steps: input, mechanism, and output. The input is the original random distribution of pennies and dimes. The mechanism here is embodied in Schelling's rules. Pick a penny or dime at random. If at least a third of its neighbors are like it, it stays. If not, it moves. The output of the model is the final arrangement of pennies and dimes, segregated patches. This is where the link to the if-then structure of experiments comes in. What the model explores is what happens if. What happens if we start with a random distribution and a one-third preference rule? What Schelling's model shows is that residential segregation could occur even without any blatant racism. None of our dimes or pennies hates the other kind. There are no pennies that move out just because a dime moves into the neighborhood. All any of them want is to have some of their own kind around. Not even half, just one-third. Models often have that three-stage structure: input, mechanism, and output. But there are lots of different purposes to which models are put, and that three-stage structure is used in lots of different ways. That's important both for your own thinking with models and for evaluating the use of models by others. Here's the basic picture. We build a three-stage model, but are really only confident of two of those stages. We use the model to tell us about the third stage. On the basis of two pieces of information we have, we use the three-stage model to give us the third piece of information we don't have, the missing piece of the puzzle. Prediction uses what we know at two stages to get new information about the future. Retrodiction uses two different stages to give us information about the past. Explanation uses the three stages in a still different way. But in each case, we build in what we know at two stages of a three-stage model and read off the information we need at the third. Let's start with prediction. Our three-stage model consists of input, mechanism, and output. In prediction, we have some confidence in our input conditions. We also think we understand our mechanism. Our model uses input and mechanism to generate an output, and that output is what we take as the model prediction. Weather prediction uses models precisely this way. We know what the weather readings are across the United States today. We know what they've been for the past week. Those are our input conditions. Over decades, we've developed certain principles that we think apply to the weather. We know what happens when a dry, cold front meets a wet, warm front. We know something about wind and the dynamics of the atmosphere. We know something about how the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains enter the picture. All those are part of the mechanism of our models. These days, the models for weather forecasting are instantiated as computer programs. The MM5 is a fifth-generation model at Penn State. The Weather Research Forecasting Model is billed as the next generation, backed by the National Center for Atmospheric Research, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Air Force Weather Agency, and the Naval Research Lab. Those models are much more complicated than Schelling's, but the basic idea is the same, a set of principles that take us from input to output. In prediction, we know our input conditions and are fairly confident of our mechanism. We read the new information we're after as the output, at the output stage, an estimate of what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. If we use an X for information we have and an O for the information we're trying to get, the case of prediction looks like this. Prediction is one thing the three-stage structure of models is good for. But sometimes what we want to know is not what's going to happen in the future, but what happened in the past. We want not prediction, but postdiction or retrodiction. Here's an example. There is still a great deal of debate as to how the moon was formed. One theory is that the centrifugal force of the spinning Earth ejected it as a chunk early in the history of the solar system. There's another theory that the moon was a separate body captured in the Earth's gravitational field. According to a third theory, the moon was formed when some other large body hit the early Earth, blasting out material that became the moon. How do we decide between those theories? How do we figure out what happened? Here's one way. Build a model. We build into our mechanism a representation of physical laws. Centrifugal force relative to rotation, the physics of velocity and impact, and gravity. We take that mechanism as given. We also take the output as given, a moon rotating the Earth in the way we know it does, with the composition we know it has. The question for the model is now, take what the theories say happened as input. Will that hypothesized input produce that output with that mechanism? Could the early Earth have rotated in such a way as to eject the moon as a chunk? Could the Earth have captured another body in its gravitational field? Could the moon have been formed by a collision with another body? If any of those inputs produces our given output with the mechanism of natural law, we have a point in favor of that particular theory. If we can't get the model to work with a particular input, we have a point against it. In prediction, we put in input and mechanism and read off the information we're after as the output. In retrodiction, we assume mechanism and output and read off the information we're after from what inputs produce that output with that mechanism. So we have two different ways of using the three-part structure of models. Put next to each other, they look like this. In this case, by the way, contemporary computer models favor the third theory. Given the mechanisms of physical law, a giant impact in the early solar system is that input that does best at producing an output that matches the size, orbit, and composition of the moon. Schelling's model uses the three-part structure in a third way. He isn't after a prediction. He isn't after a retrodiction. What he wants is an explanation. What mechanism might take us from just about any input, a fairly random one, for example, to the patterns of residential segregation we see around us? In Schelling's case, we assume an input, observe an output, and ask what mechanism would take us from one to the other. Put beside the others, the structure of explanation looks like this. Models quite standardly come with those three stages, input, mechanism, and output. But we can get three different cognitive payoffs by using that three-part structure in different ways. We may be looking for new information in model output, that's prediction. We may be considering what happens with different inputs, that's what we want for retrodiction. We may be looking for mechanisms that take us from input to output. That's what explanation is all about. Thinking with models is a great tool, but it's also a risky one with important limitations. It's important to keep those in mind when evaluating the information that models give us. Thinking with models is a way of thinking through if-then connections in the real world. We're trying to understand something real, what the weather is going to be like, how the moon was formed, or what it is that accounts for persistent residential segregation. In order to be useful, models have to be simpler than the reality that we're going to understand. But they also have to match reality in the relevant ways. If we want a reliable prediction of tomorrow's weather, our inputs have to be right. Our mechanisms have to work the way the weather really does. That's a challenge that meteorologists have been dealing with in computer models for years. The case of retrodiction is perhaps even more challenging. We can probably rely on our observations of the moon, but here too we have to be confident that our mechanism captures the relevant physical laws. Another problem with retrodiction, there might be more than one set of inputs that are sufficient to produce the outcome. Put it this way, models are made to mirror an if-then connection. If a Mars-sized body collided with the early Earth, it could have thrown out a moon that matches ours in composition and orbit. But even if our model tells us that, it doesn't tell us that's the only chain of events that could have produced that outcome. It doesn't tell us this is the only input that would give us that output. The same issue shows up in explanation. The fact that a particular mechanism leads from a particular input to an observed output doesn't tell us that it's the only mechanism that could produce that outcome. It also doesn't tell us that it's the mechanism that actually produced that result in reality. Schelling was pretty careful about all of that. He only claimed that low levels of quite ordinary preference could have produced residential segregation. That is, in fact, all that a model like his can show. It can't show that low-level preference is the only thing that could have produced that result. It can't show that low-level preference is what actually produced the result. Models are all about constructing an if-then. As we saw in an earlier lecture, that's what scientific experiments are about, too. There is, in fact, a close connection between model building and experimentation. The models we've talked about so far are conceptual models, or conceptual models instantiated in computer programs. But the history of physical models shows the same three-stage structure. There, too, the three stages can be used for prediction, or retrodiction, or explanation. In 1900, Orville and Wilbur were trying to figure out how to build a flying machine. It was going to have wings, but what kind of wings would work? What kind of wings would allow controlled flight? The Wright brothers could have tried working entirely inside their skulls. Other people had, but they didn't. They were bicycle mechanics by trade. They were used to thinking with a wrench in their hands. Their thinking about wings was hands-on, too. They built a wind tunnel, 16 inches wide, 16 inches tall, and 6 feet long. It was a finicky apparatus. Wilbur said, "Occasionally I had to yell at my brother to keep him from moving, even just a little in the room, because it would disturb the airflow." The Wright brothers moved with models of miniature wings in that wind tunnel, none over 9 inches long. As Wilbur said, "It's doubtful if anyone would ever have developed a flyable wing without it." They were after an if-then. If a wing has this structure, then it'll fly like this. Over the course of several months, they tested over 200 wing designs. They wanted to be able to predict which wing designs might actually work. But remember the limitations of models. At this point, they were only working with a model. They assumed that the forces in their miniature wind tunnel would scale up to the real world. But in physical models, as in conceptual models, as in computer models, that correspondence with reality is always a risk. Wilbur says, "We finally stopped our wind tunnel experiments just before Christmas 1901. We really concluded them rather reluctantly because we had a bicycle business to run." There have been some wonderful physical models. One of my favorites is the Mississippi Basin model in Clinton, Mississippi. The 1920s and 1930s had seen devastating flooding from the Mississippi River. In the 1940s, in order to figure out what to do about it, the Army Corps of Engineers built a miniature model of the entire river basin. Begun with labor by German prisoners of war, the model covered some 200 acres. Trees were modeled with folded screen wire at a height taken from aerial photographs, and the roughness of river bottoms was modeled by scoring and brushing concrete channels in the model. 3 days on the river could be modeled in 5 minutes in the model. That model was used for a whole range of if-thens. Can we prevent flooding in New Orleans by redirecting floodwaters into the Atchafalaya Basin? Which are the levees most at risk? The model was used in real time to guide policy in 1973 in response to 77 days of flooding from St. Louis on down. A similar physical model was constructed for the San Francisco Bay in the 1950s in order to evaluate a proposal to drain portions of the bay. What would happen if we did that? The Army Corps of Engineers built physical models in searching for an explanation of why the 17th Street Canal levee gave way under the impact of Hurricane Katrina. Conceptual models have sometimes served merely as metaphors. I think this is true of Plato's image of the cave in the Republic, for example. Plato constructs a model to illustrate his theory of the relations between appearance and reality. We are like prisoners chained in a cave. We think we see reality, but all we really see are shadows cast by light coming in from the outside. The conceptual models have often served as something more in the history of philosophy, something more like Schelling's model. The philosopher Thomas Hobbes witnessed firsthand the ravages of the English Civil War that raged from 1642 to 1651. What he wanted to understand were prospects for stability and peace. You could put his question this way: given what we know of human nature as input, what mechanism would produce stable peace as an outcome? His view of human nature was of individuals out for their own interests alone. That was his input, what he called a state of nature. In a state of nature, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. What mechanism could lead us from that to a stable peace? Hobbes called his book Leviathan, and that was his proposal for the necessary mechanism. In order to get from the state of nature to a state of stable peace, people would have to contract together. They'd have to give up their individual liberties to a central state, to a Leviathan, more specifically, to something like a monarchy. That's thinking with a three-stage model. Like all models, it has risks. We want to know how real all three stages of the model are. Are people as egoistic as Hobbes treats them in his input condition? Would a social contract really give the desired output, or would it just result in a centralized tyranny? Even if Hobbes's social contract mechanism would produce the outcome, is it the only way to do so? The most desirable way to do so? Game theory is another instance of model thinking. It assumes players' rationality and self-interest as input. It assumes a matrix of payoffs as a mechanism. It looks to see what the outcome can be expected to be with certain structured penalties and incentives. We talked about some of the risks of that kind of model thinking in the lecture on game theory. Do people behave in the way game theory assumes? Are we really homo economicus? That's a challenge to input assumption. What exactly are the values of our interactions? Why think they're captured in the matrix for the prisoner's dilemma? That's a challenge to the mechanism assumed in game theoretic models. The take-home message is this: three-stage models are a way to put strategies of visualization and simplification to work in figuring out if-thens. It often helps to think of things in terms of simplified input, mechanism, and output, whether that structure is instantiated physically, computationally, or conceptually. If you want to predict what's going to happen, work from input and mechanism. If you want to figure out what happened in the past, figure out what inputs would give you observed outputs with known mechanisms. Explanation: figure out what mechanism would lead from known inputs to known outputs. Learning to think in models can also take you farther. My friend Josh Epstein is a contemporary researcher who has built models intended to cast light on how diseases transfer across populations, how revolutions happen, and what may have happened to the ancient Anasazi in the American Southwest. In a piece called Why Model?, he offers a list of other things thinking in models is good for. Thinking with models offers tools for prediction, retrodiction, and explanation. But thinking models can also be used to guide data collection, to explore the core dynamics of a process, to suggest analogies for understanding. What are other things that work this way? To illuminate core uncertainties. Where is our knowledge most vulnerable? To point up overlooked details that might make a difference. To offer options for change or intervention. To show the simple core of complex processes and the complexities behind some simple ones. Last but not least, to suggest new questions. The next lecture is our last. I'll use that for a quick review of some of what we've done in terms of lessons from the great thinkers. What we've been assembling in the course of these lectures is the Philosopher's Toolkit. We've been pulling together a set of conceptual techniques and strategies, tips, methodologies, and rules of thumb for thinking more clearly, thinking with greater focus, more effectively, more accurately, and for building stronger and more rational patterns of inference and argument. In this lecture, I want to take a different perspective on some of those techniques and on a few more. This time around, I want to talk about the Philosopher's Toolkit in terms of some of the great thinkers who have used it and added to it. This time around, I want to look at some important thinking tools used by looking at some of the great thinkers. Everybody will have their own selection of the greats, of course, and there are plenty to choose from. I'll pick just a few, treating them chronologically, and with one central question in mind. What was it that made these thinkers great? Let's start with Plato. Though Plato, you may be surprised to learn, wasn't even his real name. He was Aristocles, son of Ariston. Plato was a nickname. It means stocky or broad-shouldered. So let's start with that great thinker, Stocky. Plato's influence has been enormous. All of Western philosophy has been characterized as a series of footnotes to Plato. But what made Plato so great? I think there are two things that stand out. First and foremost, he saw the power of abstraction. It's amazingly hard to say what abstraction is, though we all know how to do it. When you think not in terms of this specific triangle scratched in the sand, or that one drawn in chalk on the board, or this other one cast as a shadow, but about that shape in general, you're abstracting. When you think not of a Valentine's box of chocolates or a birthday or graduation present, but rather of giving in general, you're abstracting. Abstraction gives us the power of generality. It does so by simplifying. In abstraction, we simplify away the differences of different cases. The sand of triangles drawn in sand, the chalk of triangles in chalk, and think simply in terms of the shape they have in common. In order to think abstractly, you don't add on, you don't complexify, you subtract, you simplify. The realm of abstractions is what people talk of as Plato's heaven. But Plato didn't think he was talking about abstractions removed from reality. He thought the realm of abstraction was the true reality. For Plato, the world we experience around us is just an illusory, imperfect, and distant echo of the true reality of abstraction. Abstraction is a crucial tool in all individual thought. But I think there's another thing that makes Plato great, and it's entirely different. Plato's works are dialogues, not monologues. Crucial to the dialogues is interaction between multiple points of view, multiple opinions, and multiple people. The emphasis is on social rationality. Ideas is something we work through together. What about Aristotle? What makes him great? Aristotle founded logic by seeing things with a very particular vision. Deep in the complicated and messy process that is thinking, deliberation, discussion, and argument, about all the complicated and messy things that are humanly important, Aristotle saw something amazingly simple. He saw structure. The ability to see that structure gave him an idea. Maybe we can systematize thought. Thinking's often difficult. Because of built-in psychological biases, our thinking often goes wrong. We connect dots that aren't really there. But if we could systematize thought, we might be able to make it easier. If we could systematize it, we might also be able to avoid some of those biases. We could make our thinking faster and more accurate and more effective. That vision we owe to Aristotle. It's a vision that extends even into contemporary computers. systematizing, formalizing, mechanizing thought is what computers are all about. They're all built from the basic elements of logic. It's not quite Aristotle's logic, but we wouldn't have it without his precedent. But there's something else that makes Aristotle great. I think it's in direct contrast to Plato's abstraction. It's a necessary counterbalance. Plato thought it was the abstract that was truly real. Aristotle insisted on the lessons of experience. He was a real-world observer. Many of his works are cited as the first in biology, the parts of animals, the generation of animals, the movement of animals. There aren't any true experiments in Aristotle. That came much later. But he thinks that real knowledge of the world demands more than a glimpse into Plato's heaven. Real knowledge demands looking at what the real world is really like. This contrast between Plato and Aristotle is captured in Raphael's painting, The School of Athens. At the center, Raphael has painted Plato and Aristotle deep in discussion. Plato, the great teacher, is pointing upward toward the abstract. Aristotle, his rebellious student, is gesturing with a level hand toward the concrete reality before him. Any attempt to track down the first scientific experiment is bound to create controversy, both historical controversy and controversy as to what constitutes an experiment. But there's little controversy that experimentation first comes into its own during the Renaissance. Early experimentation was often used to question the authority of Aristotle. That was certainly true of Galileo, who has to rank as one of the great thinkers on anyone's list. The major lesson from the great experimenters is, don't trust authority, not even Aristotle's. Don't rely on what most people think. Don't be satisfied with what seems reasonable in an armchair. Design an experiment and put it to the test. Galileo was an aggressive and indefatigable observer. He didn't invent the telescope, for which there are patent applications in the Netherlands in 1608, but by 1609 he had built himself increasingly powerful versions, and he had turned his telescope to the heavens. Night after night, he carefully recorded craters on the moon, the phases of Venus. He not only saw the moons of Jupiter, but figured out what they really were. We've mentioned Galileo's legendary experiment, dropping a musket ball and a cannonball from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Whatever Aristotle thought, whatever anybody thought, Galileo's experiment showed that things fall at the same rate regardless of weight. But precisely how do things fall? Do they reach a designated speed and stay there? That was Aristotle's answer, by the way. Or do they keep moving faster? Precisely how much faster? In order to investigate those questions, Galileo built a model. What he really wanted to know was how things accelerate in free fall. But his tools weren't precise enough to measure that. Instead, he rolled balls down an inclined plane, a wooden ramp with a groove down the middle. With as much accuracy as his tools would allow, he measured the speed with which objects passed successive marks down the plane. He found principles that applied whatever the angle of the ramp and generalized from those to answer the question about acceleration and free fall. So one measure of Galileo's greatness, putting the question to the test. Another measure, using a question he could address in order to get a handle on a question he couldn't. If Galileo is the founding figure in modern science, Descartes may be the founding figure in both modern philosophy and modern psychology. He's known for the phrase, "I think, therefore I am." He was also the inventor of Cartesian coordinates, a triumph both of visualization and conceptual linkage. Algebraic equations translate into visual shapes in the Cartesian plane. One of Descartes' major works is the Discourse on Method of 1637. Its full title shows how it ties in with these lectures. Discourse on the Method of Rightly Conducting One's Reason and of Seeking Truth in the Sciences. And what is that method? Descartes says, divide each of the difficulties under examination into smaller parts. We called that divide and conquer. He says, starting with what is simplest and easiest to know, ascend little by little to the more complex. He says, never accept anything as true which you don't clearly know to be such. Avoid precipitancy and prejudice. The Discourse on Method is full of good advice. To be possessed of a vigorous mind isn't enough. The prime requisite is rightly to apply it. I'd certainly put Sir Isaac Newton on the list of great thinkers, but not perhaps for the reasons you'd expect. Newton is known as a great formalizer, but he was a great experimentalist as well. When bubonic plague hit England in 1664, Cambridge University closed its doors for 2 years. Newton went home to his mother's house in Lincolnshire. There, in a darkened room, he started playing with prisms. Everyone knew that light through a prism casts a spectrum of a rainbow. If you let light from a circular hole through a prism, as Newton did, the result is an oval or oblong shape that distributes the colors top to bottom. But what did that mean? The prevailing view was that the prism stained the light into different colors. But that wouldn't explain why the shape was an oblong. By ingeniously playing with prisms, Newton was able to show that what the prism did was to bend different colors of light differently, what we call different wavelengths. White light isn't one color. It's a composition of many. We know from his notebooks that Newton didn't follow any rigid scientific method. He just tried lots of things, inventively and on the fly, just to see what happened. He played with the prism just to see what happened. Only against that background did he set out systematically to try to explain what he had seen. Newton's example carries a very important lesson about the two things effective thinking requires. Each has its place, each is needed, each is worthy of respect. One requirement is creative exploration. Good thinking, whether experimental or not, requires that we take time to play with ideas. Creative conceptual play can't be forced. It can't be scheduled. It has to be play. Genuinely creative thinking can't be regimented. Children know this intuitively. But creative conceptual play isn't enough. Good thinking also requires a second phase, in which one squints critically at the creative results. One tries to tack them down and figure out what they really mean. That's the stage at which Newton asks, what precisely has been shown? Can we formulate those results more clearly? How exactly does the experiment refute established doctrine? Both of those sides of thinking, the creative and the systematic, appear in Newton's notebooks. When you read a finished scientific article, it often looks as if the work was systematic through and through. But don't be deceived. New thinking, in science, as anywhere else, has to be based in creative play. Creative play alone isn't enough. We need to tack it down. But tacking it down isn't enough either. We need creative thinking in order to give us material worth working with. I said Newton was also a great formalizer. In the 1680s, several members of the Royal Society had floated an idea as to how gravity works. The idea was that the farther two bodies were apart, the less the gravitational attraction between them. How much less? The suggestion was that their attraction fell off with the square of the distance between them. It was suggested that such a principle might explain the elliptical path of the planets around the sun. But that's as far as the idea went. Nobody could tack the idea down mathematically. Edmund Halley was a participant in that discussion. In August of 1684, he went to visit Isaac Newton in Cambridge. What kind of curve, Halley asked him, would be described by the planets, supposing the force of attraction toward the sun to be reciprocal to the square of their distance? Newton said, an ellipse. How do you know? Halley asked. I have calculated it, Newton said. Halley asked to see the calculations, but Newton couldn't find them in this messy stack of papers around him. They arrived several months later. Newton had been perfecting some details. Those calculations became the core of Newton's famous Principia. In Newton the Great Formalizer, we again see the power of simplification. He simplifies the problem of gravitational forces by first considering the attraction between just two bodies. Calculating gravitational attraction for three or more turns out to be astoundingly difficult. Newton also simplifies the problem by treating them as points rather than planets. Halley used the principles of Newton's Principia to predict that a comet that had been recorded in 1531, 1607, and 1682 would reappear in 1758. We know it as Halley's Comet. It appears every 75 to 76 years. If you missed it in 1986, that was a terrible year for visibility. Tell your grandkids to check it out in 2061. Newton's life overlaps with another great thinker, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Ironically, the thing they have in common is the thing that made them bitter enemies, the calculus. Who invented calculus? They both did, independently. Newton developed his form first, but he kept the technique secret, using it to find results which he then presented in more standard mathematical form. Leibniz developed his form a little later, but published first. These two great formalizers could have been the best of friends, but they weren't. They fell victim to all the traps of polarization, with charges and countercharges of priority and plagiarism. Indeed, their defenders continued that polarization long after both Newton and Leibniz were dead. That's a negative lesson from the great thinkers. Avoid unnecessary polarization. It was Descartes who said, "The greatest minds, as they are capable of the highest excellences, are open likewise to the greatest aberrations." Newton thought space and time were absolutes. That all changes with Einstein, who we've used as an example of great thinking throughout. Einstein was the great visualizer, amazingly flexible and looking at things an entirely different way. Now, wait a minute. I've been trying to track some of the great thinkers, but I notice that I keep coming up with either philosophers or physicists. What about the great thinkers in biology, psychology, or the social sciences? Remember that history of philosophy that I sketched in the very first lecture. In the beginning, everything was philosophy. It was only over centuries that different disciplines split off on their own. Aristotle was the first great biologist. Descartes clearly plays a major role in the history of psychology. Darwin was one of the greats, perhaps the great, in the history of biology. How is one to explain speciation, the development of species? Darwin uses a strategy of analogy. The analogy is laid out clearly in the opening passages of The Origin of Species. He says that people who have bred and worked with animals have long known that you can cultivate particular traits by selective breeding. Perhaps that same kind of selection happens in nature. That analogy is what the theory of natural selection is all about. Freud is clearly one of the greats in psychology. His major insight? That so much of our mental processing goes on below the level of consciousness. And that's a lesson we've returned to again and again. As disciplines peeled off from philosophy in the 20th century, as philosophy of mind became psychology, as philosophy of man became anthropology, as parts of social philosophy became sociology, something else happened in our intellectual history, something that carries an important lesson of its own. Single great thinkers working alone were slowly replaced by research communities working together. We've used important results from social psychology throughout the course, but that work doesn't come from a single great thinker. It's a product of social rationality. Sometimes it's not a single great thinker you need, but a great intellectual community. Even in the collaborative science of the 20th century, there are individuals who stand out. Let me end by returning to my candidate for the smartest man of the 20th century, John von Neumann. What makes von Neumann great is the fact that he worked so flexibly across so many disciplines. He's known for contributions in mathematics, in economics, in physics, in computer science. We've said that he deliberately memorized formulae in the back of textbooks. Why? So that he could recognize a similar formalism applicable across fields, so that he could see the links between very different disciplines. The lesson? Stay open to unexpected connections. Von Neumann clearly prepared for unexpected connections. As Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind. I want to apply some of the tools we've talked about to a von Neumann problem. If you do this right, you should be able to outsmart von Neumann. We've emphasized visualization. We've emphasized simplification. We've emphasized flexibility, the flexibility required to stand back and see a problem differently. I want you to use all of those, but pay particular attention to simplification. Von Neumann loved parties. At Princeton, he'd throw a party for his colleagues about once a week, heavy drinking 1950s style. Because of his reputation, people would come to the party with problems for von Neumann to solve. They'd pose him a problem. Standing there with a drink in his hand, he'd rock back and forth and try to come up with the answer, which he almost always did. Here's a problem they gave von Neumann one night. The important thing is that there's a trick to it. If you can visualize the problem flexibly and with an eye to simplification, you should be able to see the trick. Two bicycles are approaching each other from 20 miles apart. Each is going 10 miles an hour. A fly leaves the front tire of one of the bicycles at 15 miles an hour, flies to the front tire of the other, and turns around. Goes back to the first bicycle, still at 15 miles per hour, hits the front tire, turns around. The problem is idealized, of course. The bicycles go straight toward each other at a constant speed of 10 miles per hour, and the fly loses no time in turning around. The question, how far will the fly have flown by the time it's crushed between the front tires of the two bicycles? As I say, there's a trick to the question. If you tried to work it out straight, without flexibility, you'd be doing this. You'd figure out the distance from one bicycle to where the other is by the time the fly gets there, plus the distance back to where the first bicycle is then, plus the distance back to the other bicycle, all calculated in terms of that 15 miles per hour. Figuring out just that first distance is hard. Figuring out the fly's total distance would mean adding up all those progressively smaller distances, taking the infinite sum. Whew! But there's a much simpler way to get the answer. Can you see the trick? If you want to press pause for one last time, go ahead. Visualize the problem by sketching it out, and remember, simplification is the key. Here's the trick. The bicycles are 20 miles apart, approaching each other at 10 miles per hour. How long until the bicycles hit? 1 hour. The fly's speed is 15 miles per hour. So how far will it have flown by the time it's crushed between the two front tires? 15 miles. If you saw the trick, you did it the easy way. You outsmarted von Neumann. When his colleagues posed the problem, von Neumann thought about it for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and then said, 15 miles. They said, oh, so you knew the trick. What trick, he said. I just took the infinite sum. Here, then, are some tips from the great thinkers. We've really been talking about them throughout these lectures. First tip, simplify. That's how to outsmart von Neumann. We've seen that lesson in Newton and Descartes. Break a complex problem into simple parts. Start with the simple, build up to the complex. We emphasized that strategy early on in the Tower of Hanoi problem, in going to extremes, and in the strategy of thought experiments. If you can't solve a hard problem, use a simpler model. That's what Galileo did. Simplification is what model building is all about, from the Wright brothers' wind tunnel to the Mississippi River Basin model to Schelling's segregation model. Plato's abstraction represents the power of generality you can get, not by adding, but by subtracting detail, by simplifying. Second tip, look for patterns, but watch out for them, too. Visualization allows us to harness something we're great at, visual pattern recognition. It lets us think faster, more intuitively, and more powerfully. Aristotle knew the power of visualization. He used it in his square of opposition. Einstein was one of the great visualizers. The heuristics that make us smart are often forms of pattern recognition. But the biases that lead us astray are often patterns as well. Our vivid images, like images of shark attacks, can mislead us as to true probabilities. We miss the gorilla in the room because we're paying attention to some other pattern. Patterns are extremely powerful. That's why it's important to put them to work and why it's important to handle them with care. Third tip, think systematically. Maybe we can systematize thought. That was the Aristotelian vision. Thinking systematically is what gave Newton his edge. We've developed a number of tools for systematic thought, tools in statistics, in probability, and decision theory. One simple lesson in thinking systematically goes all the way to the bat and ball example in the first lecture. Want to think better? Check your work. Fourth tip, put it to the test. A respect for the reality behind the abstractions is the difference between Plato and Aristotle. Respect for reality runs throughout the whole history of experiment. Charles Sanders Peirce thought of science as the one really self-correcting technique for fixation of belief. Popper emphasizes that genuine science demands risk, the risk of falsifiability. Galileo is the patron saint of experimentation. Simple and beautiful experiments go all the way from Newton's prism to Richard Feynman's O-rings. Do you really want to know what reality entails? Ask her. Put it to the test. Fifth tip, think socially. Many of the complexities we face are social complexities. They require thinking in terms of multiple perspectives and multiple players. Thomas Hobbes knew the importance of thinking socially. So did Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That kind of thinking is the whole goal of contemporary game theory. Inevitably, there are social threats to good thinking as well. We have to watch out for mere rhetoric, for standard fallacies, for the tricks of advertisers. Newton and Leibniz are an unfortunate example of the pitfalls of polarization, even for great minds. We've tried to emphasize ways of escaping those traps. Plato's dialogues are the first great works in philosophy. They emphasize this social side to thinking. Plato takes an optimistic view. He thinks we often think most powerfully when we think together. Despite the pitfalls, I want to think he's right. Sixth tip, think with both sides of your brain. Newton combined the power of creative play with systematic critique. Great thinking requires disciplined imagination. Both parts need to be there, both the discipline and the imagination. We emphasized early on that emotion need not be the enemy of rationality if used in the right domain. We couldn't do without fast and frugal heuristics. But for long-range decisions, we need careful calculation as well. Remember Kahneman's System 1 and System 2. We need both. Let me add a seventh tip that appears in all the great thinkers. Give yourself time to think. Descartes must have been a phenomenally quick thinker. And yet he says, those who travel slowly may yet make far greater progress than those who run. Google's engineers are given one day a week to work on something entirely of their own. It's unfortunate, but these days our last bastions for free-range thinking seem to be the shower and the commute to work. Real thinking demands conceptual exploration, and that just takes time. Do like Google, do like all the great thinkers did. Give yourself time to think. Of course, the great thinkers have more lessons to teach. Don't trust authority, don't trust the majority. Don't even trust your own prejudices as to what's the obvious answer. Think for yourself. That's a lesson clear in Galileo, Descartes, and Einstein. Stay flexible. The right way to think about something may be one no one has used before. Be prepared to try a new view. Stay open to the unexpected. Each of the great thinkers worked with a conceptual toolkit, but none of them built it alone. All inherited a set of conceptual tools from their predecessors. Newton said, if I have seen farther, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. All added to the toolkit and then passed it on. That cultural heritage has now been passed to you. The Philosopher's Toolkit, to use, to apply, to add to improve, to pass on. It's wonderful to peer into the future and realize there are more great thinkers to come.